This is the Leslie Marshall Show, and I'm not Leslie Marshall. That's right. I'm breaking in. I'm taking over. This is Mark Levine, your second favorite talk show host. I got good news and bad news for you folks. For those of you who are hearing the show for the first time, I got bad news. You're losing Leslie because that was really a rerun. And now it's me, and I'm live. And to prove it, today is March 5th, all right? So I'm live Friday, March 5th, and I want people to call in and, well, take me on, of course. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. The good news is those of you who have already heard that rerun, hey, you get to hear a new live show. So you got me tonight, like it or lump it. But I love Leslie's audience. Hey, I like Leslie a lot, too. And I want to hear from you. I want to talk tonight about logic versus emotion. I want to know whether you choose your political views based on logic or emotion. Now, I think most of us would say both. My opinions are logical. And yes, I do feel if you're liberal, you feel compassion. I'm not quite sure what emotion conservatives feel. Yes, I want to take over people's lives. Maybe I don't know. Yeah, well, I want to tell people who to get married to. I want to decide. Yeah, there you go. I want to decide whether or not people get health care. I want to control other people's lives. I don't know. Maybe that's it. But I do believe that most people, and here I'm going to include both liberals and conservatives, those on the left, those on the right, those on the middle, a lot of people make their political decisions based on emotion. And as evidence for this thesis that I put forward today, I'm going to show you or play for you a lot of my recent appearances on Fox News. Now, hey, is this self-promotion? Maybe a little bit. But really, I'm trying to make a point here. And my point is that when people can't answer logical questions, when they can't debate logically, they hit back with emotion. You're right? It's kind of like kids on the playground, right? One kid calls another fat, another kid calls another stupid, another kid calls another ugly, well, it's name calling, right? And if you're fat, stupid, and ugly, you might just say, so's your mother, right? So there are people that take name calling to be debate. And one of the things I always try to do whenever I'm on television or whenever I'm on the radio is I try to give facts. I mean, is there a play to emotions? Sure. When I talk about the fact that without health care, people die in America, and that's a play on emotion, to be sure. But it's also backed up by facts. 45,000 people, 45,000 people, according to a recent Harvard study, died because they did not have adequate insurance. Now, it's a study. Maybe it's only 40,000, right? Right? We can go back and forth. You can challenge the study if you want. And yes, it's a play on your emotions. Because I think in the richest country on earth, nobody should die for inadequate health care. But I got facts. I got figures to back it up. 45,000, which is, by the way, 15 times the number of innocent people who were murdered on September 11th. And that makes me very angry. Shouldn't it make me very angry as well that 15 times that number die every year from lack of adequate insurance? Okay, so that's one study. I have to admit there's another study I read a few years back that said only 22,000, big difference, 22,000 people die from inadequate health insurance. Either way, it's a lot of people. So I would suggest to you that when you look at the heart, deep down in the heart of a liberal, and deep down in the heart of a conservative, you find a dramatic difference when they hear these statistics. Because a liberal says, oh my God, people are suffering through no fault of their own. They're Americans. We're the richest country on earth. Why are people dying? And a conservative says, phew, I'm glad I'm not poor. I'm glad I'm not one of them. I hope they don't want to take tax money from me to help some poor child who's got leukemia because, you know, it's my money and I earned it or I inherited it from my great-grandfather. Either way, that poor person isn't me. They're of the I got mine, Jack, school. And I think at the essence, there's a lot of logic, no question about it. And I can argue, as I argue today, in fact, that health care actually helps the economy, helps everybody, that providing people who don't have health care, even if you've got health care through your employer, you provide people who don't have health care, and it helps you. How? Well, for one thing, they stop using the emergency room, right? A lot of people have to get their health care through the emergency room. Now we can unclog the emergency room, and now, heck, rich and middle-class people can use it too. What I want to explore over the next 3 hours is is helping the poor people an issue of compassion, or is it an issue of logic? And I will say to you, it's not just compassion. Even if you have no compassion, even if you're the I got mine Jack school, even if you don't care what happens to the poor, it still helps the economy and it helps you to take care of them. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. What do you think? Be right back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is your second favorite talk show host, Mark Levine, filling in for Leslie Marshall this evening. And my question for you is, how do you decide your political views? Is it based on logic? Is it based on emotion? Is it based on a bit of both? Because I have to tell you, when liberals and conservatives hear words, different images pop up in their mind. When you say the word healthcare, when you say healthcare reform, what do liberals think of? They think of somebody they know whose insurance doubled or who kept a job that they didn't like just in order to get the health care that they need. They think of the 45 million people who are uninsured. They think of children who are not covered and therefore can't get adequate health care. What do conservatives think of when they hear health care reform? They think people filing frivolous lawsuits. They think of doctors not getting paid enough. They think that their taxes are going to be increased. They think, why should I have to pay just because someone else's baby is sick? It's not my baby. Let it die. I didn't create the baby. I didn't create the problem. It's not my problem. And so for a liberal to approach a conservative on healthcare, you've got to be able to convince the conservatives that actually, even if you have no compassion, and most conservatives don't, even if you have no compassion, it still behooves you to have everybody covered. And I think it does. And I'm going to talk about that in the next 3 hours. How specifically, even if you have no compassion, health care helps you. Specifically, the health care reform bill that's being put forward by President Obama. Now, I'll be the first to tell you, hang on, liberals, I'll be the first to tell you that I don't think it goes far enough. I'll be the first to tell you I think we need a public option. But I do think it goes pretty far. We're going to talk in these 3 hours about what is in the health care bill and why I think that it's much better than nothing. But I want you to understand that when we talk about the logic, when the cost of the bill and the fact that it covers people with pre-existing conditions and the fact that if everyone is under the system, then everyone is insured and people stop having to go to emergency rooms. Those are all logical arguments, and I'll make them. But you've got to understand there's an emotional core that you have to hit before you can make the logical arguments, before people even hear you. And it's not just about health care. You heard Leslie in the opening talk about the United States Supreme Court arguing that everybody's got the right to own a gun. And we'll talk about the limits of that too. Hey, we got a whole evening together. We'll talk about the limits of gun control. We'll talk about the Second Amendment. But you've got to understand that I may talk as logically as I want about the actual Second Amendment to the United States Constitution, the one that talks about a well-regulated militia, and we'll read the text over the air, and I'll make my logical argument. But to most people who love their guns, it's not about logic. It's about, I love my guns, and I want my guns, and I like them a lot. And you say, but wait a minute, maybe a violent felon shouldn't have a gun. They say, I like my guns. And you say, what do you think a violent felon should own a gun? And they say, Mark, I like my guns. And if you say, well, the Second Amendment talks about a militia, they say, I like my guns. You see, those aren't logical arguments.
No!
They're not. I was just recently on Bill O'Reilly's show Tuesday night talking about the Second Amendment. I'll play some clips for you. I'm trying to sort of give you a heads up of what's coming up in the next 2.5 hours or so. But what's fascinating to me was not my exchange with Bill O'Reilly. We actually had an interesting exchange based on constitutional law. You'll hear him, you'll hear me, and like most shows, most O'Reilly factors, well, he talks over me and I try to get a word edgewise. That's standard for Bill O'Reilly. But we actually do have a discussion on the text of the Second Amendment. What's interesting to me is not so much that, because I think that's rare. What's interesting to me is the responses I got. Some 25 comments are now on my website. Some of them are me responding to these people, calling me every name in the book. Instead of addressing my Second Amendment arguments, they're insulting me. All right, I can take it. I have thick skin. In fact, I laugh because if you are busy insulting me, that to me is evidence that you don't know what you're talking about. And in the breaks, you might want to read the comments at marklevineradio.com. Ask yourself if these people actually know what they're talking about. Or ask yourself if somebody wins an argument with you and you know they're right, whether you don't just go ahead because you're upset and say, so's your mother or whatever. Whatever, right? That's the classic, right? Whatever. Whatever means, yeah, you're probably right, but I'm not going to fight you and I'm going to get the last word. It's tough to argue. You can't argue with a whatever. You can't argue with a, I love my guns. You can't argue with, you're an effing moron, which one person very kindly, or not so kindly, said to me on my website. You can't argue with that. But you have to understand the difference between how liberals and conservatives see guns. When a liberal hears the word gun, he or she often thinks of gang violence, of innocent victims getting shot, of people bringing guns to schools, of crazy people getting guns through the gun show loophole and then shooting up schools, or the horrible man who took over an Amish schoolhouse in Pennsylvania, or maybe even weapons other than guns and people like Timothy McVeigh using them. And that's what liberals think of. Conservatives often think about the good times hunting with their dad. Or they think about self-defense. They think about, oh, a guy comes into my home. I want to have a gun to defend myself. Now, in the gun case, I think both liberals and conservatives, at least as I've defined them here, are right. Guns are a tool. You can use them for hunting or self-defense. And let me be the first to say, I got no problem with that, folks. None. Or you can use it to kill, maim, murder. Children can accidentally use it to shoot themselves. So I believe that, yes, you can have reasonable regulation of guns. I wouldn't ban guns. I don't know many liberals that would. But you can have reasonable regulation on guns so that violent felons and crazy people don't get a hold of them. That makes sense to me. But before I can make a logical argument on guns, I got to get around the emotion, right? The, don't take my guns. Obama's going to take my guns. Obama's not going to take your guns. If you're sane and you're an adult and you haven't committed any violent felonies, nobody's going to take your guns away, okay? Just chill. Chill. And please don't shoot me. It's not just healthcare. It's not just guns. Recently, I'm proud to say, in fact, just Wednesday, the day before yesterday, something that I admit that I was involved in. The District of Columbia, where I sit right now, is allowing full marriage equality. That means everyone, every consenting adult in the District of Columbia can marry any other consenting adult they're not related to, whether or not they're a man or a woman. Some people call that gay marriage. I think that's unfair. I call it marriage because that's what it is. Because I don't call blacks and whites marrying mixed marriages or race mixing. I just call it marriage. And that's a good thing. But now what do liberals and conservatives think of when they hear marriage equality, right? Liberals think of equality under the law. They think marriage equality. They think, why shouldn't people have equal rights? And they think of their gay friends and neighbors or family members who they like, or maybe even some gay people they don't like, but they understand that gay people are people and should have every rights that straight people have. What do conservatives think? They think, oh my God, the gays are taking over. Most conservatives don't know any gay people, and if they do, they haven't talked with them. Maybe it's, you know, some, you know, somebody that they work with, or someone who sells them groceries, or maybe it's their doctor or their lawyer. Note that I did not use stereotypical things like hairdresser and florist. I didn't. But most conservatives think religiously. They think, oh my God, someone's going to make me marry a gay person. Please don't do that. I'm straight. I don't want to marry a gay person. Well, let me tell you, conservatives, calm down. I swear we will not make you marry a gay person, I promise. The funny thing is that straight people marry gay people all the time, and conservatives support those marriages. They say it's just fine for a gay man to marry a straight woman, and in fact, they can do that, and that's why they don't need to marry a gay man. Well, they don't mean it. They don't want their daughters to marry a gay man. They don't want their sons to marry a lesbian, and it's not good. But again, note how we differ, whether it's poverty, or healthcare, or guns, or the right of gay people to marriage equality. Whatever the situation is, you simply say the word abortion, marijuana, all the hot button issues, and immediately conservatives have one image in their mind, liberals have another image in their mind. And my question for you is, how do we come together? How do we use logic without giving up the emotion I know is there? How do we talk to each other? How do we find compromise? Or do we give up? Are we really just living in two different Americas? 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. This is Mark Levine. What do you think? Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine, your second favorite talk show host, filling in for Leslie Marshall and talking about how people use logic or emotion in their arguments. And what's fascinating to me is that on any number of topics, whether it's guns or healthcare, whether it's the right of gay people to get married, or whether it's poverty, people have different conceptions in their mind of what matters. And in doing so, they often talk past each other rather than to each other. And I want to talk about how we talk to each other. But first, let's do a little past each other. Recently, I was on Bill O'Reilly's show, The Factor, and Bill and I talked about two things. We talked about guns and healthcare. Let me play for you, first of all, our exchange on guns and explain to you, if you didn't know already, and certainly Bill O'Reilly, if he didn't know already, what is in the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution.
Now for the top story tonight. Do I have it wrong about the progressive movement? Joining us from Washington, constitutional attorney and radio talk show host Mark Levine and Penny Hill, a former advisor to Senator Harris. It's the court. And the Supreme Court will decide about this McDonald Chicago. It's not the government, because the government serves the folks, Ms. Lee. You got to understand that.
But
what the Obama administration is putting forth, and I want Mr. Levine to address this, is look, you do this, buy health insurance, for example, for the greater good. You do that, give up all your guns because we don't like them. And that is drifting toward a very, very authoritative state, Mr. Levine, is it not?
Well, no one's asking anyone to give up all their guns, Mr. O'Reilly.
Well, they're asking Mr. McDonald to give up his gun, and he says he has a legitimate need for it. Yes, that's why the court is hearing the case.
The people of Chicago voted to have gun regulations. Now, I am a liberal strict constructionist. I believe literally in the terms of the Constitution, which says that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. No one's taking away anyone's militia rights. But apart from a militia, it seems to me that instead of having judicial activists determine what guns you can have and what guns you shouldn't have, we should rely on the elected representatives of the people.
You did a little sleight of hand, Mr. Levine. You left out the comma because you read something. Now, there is a comma in that what you just read. Now, a well-regulated militia no longer exists in America, okay? But there's a comma after that. And the right of citizens to bear arms shall not be infringed. It doesn't say militia members.
It says the right of the people.
Doesn't say militia members. And it's clear if you look at the letters, Mr. Levine, if you look at the letters, and I have one by Thomas Jefferson, I personally own it, okay, that they wanted individual, you didn't have to be in a militia. You could have been a farmer. They wanted individuals to have protections against tyranny, which is what Mr. McDonnell wants. But I don't want to debate
history. What's in the text of the Constitution. I just want to be clear here. I'm a strict constructionist.
The Supreme Court has ruled for 270 years.
They ruled that last year. They ruled the other way throughout
our history.
Okay, so that was quite a lengthy exchange, and we talked a lot at the same time. I think he interrupted me more than I interrupted him. But I want to unpack that exchange because there's a lot going on in that little exchange. And by the way, if you want to watch it when we're through, just go to marklevineradio.com and you can watch the entire exchange again. So there's a lot of questions there, right? The first question is one of constitutional law. And the question is, how do you read the Constitution of the United States? And that's a fair question, right? How do you read the Constitution of the United States? So in order to determine whether individuals have a Second Amendment right to own guns, I did what anyone should do when they're doing constitutional interpretation. I took out my pocket constitution, which I carry with me wherever I go, and I read it to Bill O'Reilly. And I'm going to read it to you from the same pocket constitution. Got in front of me right now. Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia, comma, I'll read the commas since Bill O'Reilly seems to really care about the commas. A well-regulated militia comma. By the way, not just a regulated militia, but a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, comma, sorry, shall not be infringed. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, let's talk about what this says. First of all, it's interesting that Bill O'Reilly read it wrong. He said the right of the citizens to bear arms. And I said, Bill, it doesn't say citizens. It says the people. So you might say, Mark, attorney, your word, citizens, people, it all means the same thing. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Because the Constitution of the United States sometimes talks about people and sometimes talks about persons. And there's a difference. Believe it or not, there's a difference between people and persons. For example, the Fourth Amendment says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, right? The right of the collective right of all of us, the people, to be secure in our persons, in our individual persons. When it comes to the criminal law, it says no person, doesn't say the people, no person shall have put themselves in double jeopardy or be forced to incriminate against themselves and so forth. It talks about persons. It talks about individuals. But what's the people? Well, all you have to do is read the preamble. We the people, right? You've heard that before. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility. Does that mean the people have an individual right to establish justice? It says so right here. We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, is that something we're going to do as individuals? Are we going to establish justice as individuals? Are we going to provide for the common defense as individuals? I don't know about you. I mean, I'm ready to defend my country, but I don't want to do it alone. It's a collective right. Whenever the Constitution says people, it's a collective right. Whenever it says person, it's an individual right. Like when the 14th Amendment says that no person shall be denied equal protection under the law. Right? Pretty clear, huh? So when the Second Amendment says the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed because a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state, that seems pretty clear to me. The people have a right to be in a well-regulated militia. Not just any militia. Hear me up there in Idaho? Hear me, those that would form militias that help Timothy McVeigh? No. A well-regulated, a state-regulated militia. Or at least a well-regulated people's militia, but one that's regulated. That doesn't mean you have an individual right to bear arms. Bill O'Reilly is simply wrong on the Constitution. And that's okay. He has a right to be wrong. But at least he's arguing about the actual text of the Constitution. By the way, that comma he's talking about, that is what separates, and I'm sorry to get all grammatical on you, but separates a dependent clause from an independent clause. A well-regulated militia being necessary to secure a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That is a modifier. Go back to your fourth grade grammar class. That's what dependent clauses do. You could have said in the Second Amendment, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's not what it says. What Bill O'Reilly and what conservatives would have you think is that that whole first sentence in the Second Amendment is meaningless. It's superfluous. It's mere surplusage, as they say in the law. Really? The Constitution is mere surplusage? I'm a strict constructionist. I choose to believe that words have meaning. Bill is a judicial activist. He wants courts to decide what guns we can or we can't have. I say let the people decide. Am I a liberal? Am I a conservative? Or am I just somebody who respects the Constitution? And in response to all of this, what do I get? What do I get on my website, marklevineradio.com? Comment after comment, what do I get? I get, you're a effing moron. I got regularly insulted, and if you want to call me an effing moron, you have absolutely every right to do it. I support your free speech. Go to my blog and say I am. That's fine. But it seems to me that if you can't respond to my arguments in their constitutional context, then maybe I'm not the effing moron. And if you love your guns, let me be very, very clear, gun lovers, if you love your guns, that's okay with me. I ain't going to take them away. Just because you don't have a constitutional right to own guns outside a militia doesn't mean we're going to go around confiscating them. It means that your elected representatives, chosen by you, should make the decision rather than unelected judges. And what's so wrong with that? 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Right back at the top of the hour.
The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
Welcome to the Leslie Marshall Show. Thank you for that switch. Chris, the producer, switched from I'm a woman to I'm a man, because, yeah, I mean, I am, so. But Leslie, being, of course, someone who does not discriminate on the basis of gender, has decided to let me, a mere mortal male, to come on the show in place of the wise, wonderful woman who normally does, that's pretty good alliteration on spur of the moment, who does normally do this show, All right, enough of that. I am talking about logic versus emotion and how we make our arguments. And just before the break, I gave you a constitutional law class. Hopefully it wasn't that boring, but a very important one, because you'll find that most people who love their guns will insist that the Second Amendment to the Constitution protects their right to own guns. How many of them have actually read the Second Amendment to the Constitution? I think people often believe that if they believe something really, really, really strongly, then it's in the Constitution, or it ought to be in the Constitution, or we'll treat it as if it's in the Constitution, as if the Constitution were just, well, anything you want it to be. It's not. It's an actual document, and it has words in it, and the words have meaning. And the irony is that you often hear conservatives complain that liberal judges are activists, that liberal judges aren't obeying the strict construction of the Constitution. And they say that when liberal judges do things like, oh, I don't know, allow blacks and whites to go to school together, or say that a woman's right to do what she wants with her own body is protected. Well, that's what they say, right? They say, liberal activist judges, they're terrible. And there's some liberals that jump into that construct that conservatives create. They say, oh, yeah, yeah, we want a living, evolving document. Well, I believe in a living, evolving constitution, but I also believe in taking the words seriously. And I think we can do both. Right, when the Fourth Amendment says that you have the right to be secure in your persons, houses, papers, and effects, secure in your persons, by the way, note persons, individuals. That's why women have a right to be secure in their persons and not have somebody tell them that they're forced to have a baby against their will. I see the right to Roe v. Wade in the Fourth Amendment, actually. But when it also says houses, papers, and effects, does that include a computer? Well, I think it does, because the whole point of the Fourth Amendment is that your private thoughts, your private papers should be protected, and that unless the court magistrate has a reasonable belief to think you've committed a crime and gets a warrant, you're protected. You are secure in your persons, houses, papers, and effects. Yeah, I throw Constitution in under papers and effects. That, to me, is part of a living, evolving Constitution. That makes sense. That is logical. But when conservatives say that the 14th Amendment, passed right after the Civil War, and the one that said that all persons born in the United States are citizens of the United States, and was done specifically to allow slaves, or former slaves, to be citizens of the United States, when they say that the 14th Amendment actually protects corporations, and that person there means corporation, I say, guys, it ain't in my Constitution. The word corporation isn't in the Constitution, and I'm weird enough that I actually think person means person and not corporation. Now who's being the judicial activist? To me, saying papers and effects include your computer, that makes sense. To me, saying person means a corporation, that doesn't make sense at all. Doesn't make sense at all. And the same is true with the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment does not say the right of persons to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, which would be an individual right. Even though Bill O'Reilly said so. It's fascinating to me. Here, Bill O'Reilly is planning a show, right? He is planning a show. This was his topic. I didn't choose the topic. This is Bill O'Reilly's show. It's called The Factor. That's his name. It's his show. He decided to discuss the Second Amendment. That was his decision. And yet, he didn't have a copy in front of him. Okay, fine. So he memorized it. No, he memorized it wrong. He got it wrong. Now, I don't expect every citizen, even those that love their guns, to know the exact text of the Second Amendment. But if you were going to do a show on a small part of the Constitution, one that's about, 30 words long, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 28. Pretty good, Mark. If you're going to do something on an amendment that's less than 30 words long, do you think you could say it right if you prepare a show? Come on, Bill. No, he said the right of the citizens to keep arms because that's what he thinks it is. He thinks it's an individual right. So in his mind, using the emotion that he wants it to be an individual right, he actually did a nice little Freudian slip. And so I remind him on the air, it's not citizens, Bill, it's the people. The people, because as I said, the people, that's a collective right. It's like we, the people of the United States, in order to form a perfect union, establish justice. I don't think individuals in the United States have the right to establish justice, right? Are you going to establish your own courts? The people have that right, but do you personally have that right? I don't think so, right? Promote the general welfare? Secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves? Well, that's plural, right? The people. Secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves, not to ourselves. Anyway. I don't mean to overemphasize the point. The point is, it's obvious. It's obvious. And not only is it obvious to me, but it's been obvious to every single court of the United States of America from 1791, when the Bill of Rights became law, until 2008 or 2009, I'm not sure which, until a year or two ago, when the five justices of the Supreme Court, and I use the word justice loosely, declared that, there's an individual right in the Second Amendment. And that's another thing that Bill O'Reilly got wrong. Very, very interesting where he gets his facts wrong. Now, I'm not saying he's doing this intentionally. I don't think he is. I actually think that Bill O'Reilly is honorable enough that he would not intentionally mislead you. I don't think when he said, it's been held that way for hundreds of years, I think he believed it. I just don't think he looked it up. He just assumed it. Just like he assumed that there was an individual right, that it went to citizens rather than the collective right of the people. Just like he assumed the United States Supreme Court had always found individual right there, when actually it's a new thing. In fact, there's the most recent case on it dates back to 1933, where the Supreme Court very clearly held there's no individual right, but by the way, don't try to take away people's militias, because that's the right that's protected. Well, regulated militias, right? Sorry, Timothy McVeigh. Not just militias, but regulated militias, not just regulated, but well regulated. That's what's protected. And Bill O'Reilly assumed wrongly that the Supreme Court had held the other way. No, it's a new thing. The same five, well, not the same five justices, three of the same five justices that decided that Bush could win the election even though Gore got the most votes in Florida and in the rest of the nation. And two of the justices appointed by the president, selected by Scalia and Rehnquist and Thomas, and O'Connor, Kennedy. That president selected by them selected two more justices who don't seem to believe that the words of the Constitution have any meaning. Okay, they're what we call judicial activists. And I'm going to urge liberals across America, do not let conservatives claim that they're the ones with fidelity to the Constitution. Because we are. We are. I am. Maybe not all liberals are. But I believe in the rule of law. I believe in the Constitution. The Constitution prohibits torture. Which president did torture? The Constitution prohibits searches and seizures without a warrant. Which president spied on hundreds of millions of Americans? The Constitution prohibits the establishment of a religion. Which president wanted to create an initiative giving government money to religions? All of that was George Bush, right? The Constitution says that if you are taken, you have a right to a counsel. Which president denied American citizens the right to have a lawyer? That would be George W. Bush. So don't give me this, conservatives respect the Constitution. I wish they did. If they did, we'd have a lot less to argue about. But they don't. And they don't not because they're stupid. They don't because they willfully don't want to believe the language of the Constitution says what it says. Bill O'Reilly is an intelligent man. Bill O'Reilly prepared a show on the Second Amendment. Bill O'Reilly didn't take the time to review or memorize the less than 30 words of the Second Amendment, not because he was trying to fool people, I don't think, but because he willfully did not want to believe it was true. And I got to say something. It's not just conservatives that do this. Liberals do it too. There are liberals that say, oh, Bush is evil. He must have blown up the Twin Towers. No, there's no evidence of that. The liberals that say, oh, Bush must have been a Nazi. No, he was a terrible president, but he wasn't a Nazi. When will we get rid of our emotions and actually look at the language, read the language of the Constitution, read the language of the law, speak to each other using logic? It's not just about gun rights, my friends. It's also about health care. It's about poverty. Know logic and use it. And don't just go to your emotions. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall, talking about logic and emotion and how we defend our beliefs, really, liberals and conservatives. And, while in the break, of course, I'm reading my favorite document. And, okay, I'm a geek. I admit it. I'm a constitutional lawyer. I'm also a geek in my spare time. In the break, yeah, I flip through my pocket constitution, I read it, and one of the things I should have mentioned, I thought it was in here, is Article 1, Section 8, because I mentioned that a well-regulated militia, and I said, well, who regulates it? Could it be private? Well, it actually says so right here. Congress has the power to organize, arm, and discipline, and govern the militia. The states can appoint the officers, but training the militia, in other words, regulating the militia, it's got to be done according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. So there you go. You have the right to bear arms to participate in a militia regulated by Congress and the several states. But there's another part in Article 1, Section 8, talking about the powers of Congress that I want to read about. It has to do with a completely different issue, but one I argued with Bill O'Reilly, and that's health care. You've heard a lot about health care. Well, Bill O'Reilly doesn't want people to have to pay for health care. Now, we've talked in the past about why it's important that everyone be involved in the system. It's to prevent what economists call a free rider problem, where you ride on someone else's generosity. And let me explain. Let's say you're 25 years old, and let's say you're in picture-perfect health. And let's say you don't think you need health care. And you know what? To be honest, you don't at that moment. So you decide, I'm not going to buy health care. Why should I pay money? I'm not going to use it. You're kind of like the homeowner that says, I'm never going to have a fire, so I'm not going to buy fire insurance. Right? But then, the next day, you get leukemia. Or you get hit by a car. Either way, you need emergency health care. You don't have health insurance. What do? You get upset. You go to your nearest emergency room. And we as a society have two choices. We can either say, you made a bad decision. You should have gotten health care and you didn't. You should suffer the consequences of your decision. You should die. Goodbye. Sorry. Better luck next life. Next time, get health care. But why should we pay for you? Chicken Little, right? Was it Chicken Little? No, I think it was a Little Red Hen. I don't remember my fables. The one who built the pie, made the pie, and no one else wanted to help make the pie, and so they couldn't get any of the pie. All right, I'm going far afield. But you get my point, right? We say to the 25-year-old, sorry, you should have gotten health care insurance. You didn't. You die. And there are conservatives who believe that. Most liberals don't. Most liberals say, well, we can't just let a human being die, even if they're stupid enough not to provide for themselves. But if we have to provide for that person, and by the way, we do, there's a law passed through, guess what, budget reconciliation. There's an emergency treatment law that says you have to treat someone who's dying, whether or not they have health care insurance. So the 25-year-old, knowing that law or knowing that people won't let him die, now he's got it even better, right? He knows, he's cool, he doesn't have to pay for any insurance. And then if he gets sick, he'll be taken care of anyway. Free riding. He'll ride on somebody else's generosity, in this case, taxpayers. Is that fair? I don't think so. I think we should all pay into the system because you know what? We all live, we all die. That means at some point in every one of our lives, we will get sick. It's part of the nature of mortality. That's just the way it works. But Bill O'Reilly doesn't think that people should have to pay for health care. He doesn't think that that's a good idea. He doesn't want to pay for someone who's sick, I guess. So he says it's not in the Constitution. Well, I'll read for you Article 1, Section 8. It says the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Now, if health insurance isn't general welfare, pray tell me what is. Listen to this exchange between Bill O'Reilly, and then we'll talk about it after the break.
Into this system is going to save us all costs, and it's going to lower everyone's costs. So it's a good thing that everyone.
I'm not arguing that there's a reason they do it. I'm saying, Mr. Levine, it's authoritarian. The progressive movement. George Soros yesterday, did you hear this on a factor? Says, oh, Obama should have nationalized all the banks, taking them right over. George Soros, head of the progressive movement.
That's not what Democrats think. Bill, let me ask you a question. Do you think it's authoritarian that the government taxes you to pay for police force? That the government taxes you to pay
for firefighters? They have the right in the Constitution to levy taxes.
They do?
Yep.
But wait, I may not use the police force. I may not use the firefighters.
They have the right in the Constitution.
They force me to buy for something
Mr. Levine,
I don't need.
You asked a very good question, and I'll give you an excellent answer. They have the right under the Constitution to levy taxes on me, and they do. And they use that right every single day. They don't have the right to force me to buy something. That's not in the Constitution, sir. They can't do
that.
Well,
that's what you're buying. You're buying health care. Health care is for everyone. Look, a lot of states force you to buy car insurance.
Health care is for everyone. I'm sure there are people out there going, I don't want it. I don't want it.
So everybody lives or dies, Bill. Everybody needs health care.
Some people want to die.
It's like the police.
And after this discussion,
I think
there'll be more of them.
You know, some people may not want firefighters.
All right, Ms. Lee, I'm going to get...
not want the police.
I'm going to give you the last word. All right.
Okay, now I don't know if you heard all of that. We were talking over each other. But the point is clear. If they can tax you to pay for police force, they can tax you to pay for health care. It's all part of the general welfare. And you may think you will never need the police. And you may think you will never need firefighters. And you may think you will never need health care. But I'll tell you this. Not everyone does use the police in their lifetime. Not everyone does have a firefight in their lifetime. But every single American, sometime before they die, needs health care. 888-653-7543. Back after this. Only the good die young. That's right. Only the people that need health care and can't get it die young. And you know what's interesting about that song, about all of this debate, is again how we view these terms. How we view, for example, poor people. When a liberal thinks of a poor person, a liberal thinks of someone who's down on his or her luck. Someone who might be working 2-3 jobs but just can't make ends meet. Somebody who just can barely afford to pay the rent, to put food on the table. Someone making minimum wage or just above minimum wage, struggling to feed their families. When conservatives think of poor people, they think of, well, good-for-nothing welfare queens, right? Ronald Reagan's term. When they think of welfare, they think of welfare fraud. They think of people abusing the system, choosing not to work, lying to authorities, getting money that they can, and living it high on their $5,000 welfare check. It's not easy to live high on that, but yeah, they do the best they can. It's fascinating because many times liberals and conservatives switch roles when talking about rich people, right? Liberals think of the Bernie Madoffs in the world, the Michael Eisners who make $200 million even as they run Disney into the ground, the Ken Lays of Enron, the Halliburtons run by Dick Cheney, companies that are misusing public funds, that are stealing from the people, that are committing fraud. We think of rich people fraud, right? Conservatives think of rich people who are actually doing a good job and making products, maybe someone like Steve Jobs at Apple. The answer, of course, is we're both right. There are good rich people. There are bad rich people. There are good poor people. There are bad poor people. There are rich and poor people who play by the rules and do the best they can. There are rich and poor people who commit fraud and cheat the system. I'm going to give you an independent view that's neither liberal nor conservative, and it may sound crazy, but I think the good people should win and the bad people should lose. All right, a little simplistic. If you commit fraud, I don't care whether it's welfare fraud or securities fraud. That's not good. You should go to jail. Although I will say this, and here's where my liberal tendencies come in. If you commit minor welfare fraud in order to get a scrap of bread to feed your starving child because you have to pay extra because your kid has leukemia and you don't have health care, I got a little sympathy for you. That's right, Jean Valjean of Les Misérables. I got sympathy for you. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you can just move on. the guy in the great French novel by Victor Hugo in Les Misérables put in jail for stealing a loaf of bread to feed his family. All right, I understand why poor people, some, might have to commit fraud. They shouldn't, and I'm against it. But if it's to feed your starving child, all right, I'm okay with it. There's no excuse for Bernie Madoff. There's no excuse for Ken Lay. There's just no excuse for that. But the point is, when we hear poor, when we hear rich, what do you think of? Who do you think of? I swear, when rich people hear poor, not rich people, when conservatives hear the word poor, most of them, it seems to me, forget the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, even though many of them are very religious people, who talked about the meek shall inherit the earth, who said it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter heaven. They forget the teachings of Jesus who cared about the poor, and they think, well, it's probably your fault anyway. So what that your dad's in jail? So what that your mom's on crack? It's your fault, kid. You're 7. Get a job. Or you're 4. Or you're 2. Get a job. Well, not every 6-year-old can get a job. I don't even know that we want 6-year-olds working, frankly. So recently, I was on CNBC talking with Michelle Caruso, right-wing conservative, about the minimum wage. And again, I think we were talking past each other. You see, I make the assumption, as I do with the fact that people get emergency medical treatment, even if they don't buy health care, which is why I want everyone to buy health care. I make the assumption that nobody gets so poor that they should die in America. I don't care how stupid you are. I don't care what mistakes you've made. I think every single American, call me socialist, but I think every single American has the right to go to a soup kitchen and get food, to have shelter so they don't have to huddle under a bridge and die in the snow. Food, shelter, basic health care so they don't die of some curable disease. And an education, which is the only chance we have to escape poverty. That's how Barack Obama escaped poverty. That's how Bill Clinton escaped poverty. And mind you, both of them, raised by single parents, were poor. Education was the way out. That's all I'm asking for. Food, clothing, shelter, and education. And if you think that's too much to give, ask yourself what we give our prisoners. What do we give murderers and rapists? We give them food. It's not great food, but it's food. We give them shelter. It ain't great shelter, but it's shelter. They don't die in the elements. We give them basic health care. And yes, in virtually every prison in America, we give them a chance at education. And if we're going to do this to people who commit rape, if we're going to do this to people who brutally beat people up, Can we not do it to a poor slob, low on his luck? Maybe he's high on drugs. Can we not do it to his or her child? Should we not give American citizens the basic minimums we give our violent felons? So I assume that we're going to give basic minimums to people in our society. But I admit, it's a slippery slope. Because once you know that you're going to take care of people in a minimum way, then you have to ask yourself, why shouldn't we have a minimum wage as well? After all, if you don't have a minimum wage worthy of working, somebody's going to be on welfare, and taxpayers are going to pay for it anyway. Wouldn't it be better for a company to pay for it than taxpayers? Wouldn't it be better for a poor person to earn his or her living? All you Republicans that hate welfare, wouldn't you like to put someone to work? No, because they're not concerned about the poor. Virtually every conservative plan I've heard of is about transferring wealth from the poor to the rich. I don't care whether it's health care or education or tax policy. I don't care whether it's restrictions on global warming, the estate tax, Social Security, Medicare, you name it. And virtually every conservative proposal that exists is all about reverse Robin Hood, taking money from the poor and giving it to the rich. And recently, as I said on CNBC, in fact, today, I had an argument with Michelle Caruso, the host of, what's the name of that show? I was just on Power Money, Power Lunch, Power Hour, whatever it's called. I was just on her show today, and we had a debate over the minimum wage, which I'm going to play for you right after the break. You can still call in, though, and discuss this topic, the minimum wage or health care or guns or just logic versus emotion. Just pick up the phone. The lines are free, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543, 888-653-7543. My debate with Michelle Caruso right after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine, your second favorite talk show host, filling in for Leslie Marshall, my good friend and your favorite talk show host. And we're talking about, logic, emotion, how people perceive issues, and really how it's framed. Because whether it's guns, whether it's poverty, whether it's the right of gay people to get married, or whether it's global warming, people have these perceptions, some of which are based in fact, but most of it seems to be based in emotion. And sometimes we just talk past each other. I had a recent conversation on CNBC. Actually, recently it was today. Maybe some of you saw it. It was this afternoon. I was on CNBC on Power Lunch, it's called, talking about the minimum wage. Now, you know the conservative argument. The conservative argument is that if we allow poor people to get a decent wage, then employers won't want to hire poor people. See, they don't think that whether or not you make cars or you make books or you make, anything. It's not, sell gasoline. It's not based on demand for milk or gasoline or cars. But it's based on whether employers decide to do it or not. Yeah. And so employers will do it if wages are cheap, but they won't do it if wages are expensive. I happen to think that employers are going to try to satisfy demand no matter what it is. Well, no. I mean, there are laws of supply and demand. I admit that. But the question is whether the minimum wage truly leads to a lot of unemployment. And one of the things that I was pointing out is that if you don't have the minimum wage, you're going to have more money that taxpayers have to pay, more people on welfare. And you're also, with the minimum wage, going to have a strong economy because poor people spend more than rich people. But listen as myself and the conservative host Michelle Caruso and the Republican Terry Holt, listen as we all talk past each other. Oh, we should go to break? Oh, you know what? No. I got time. I got time. I've been watching my clock. No problem, Chris. All right, let's go on. Let's play the clip from CNBC.
Skilled workers staying stubbornly high. Wall Street Journal editorials page says you should blame it on the recent hikes in the minimum wage. Quote, to raise the cost of unskilled labor precisely when the jobless rate is heading toward 10% is an act of almost willful economic stupidity. Is raising the minimum wage a job killer? Does it just hurt the poor? Squaring off in the power grid, Democratic policy analyst Mark Levine and Republican strategist Terry Holt. Guys, you both have 20 seconds to make your case. Terry, let's start with you. What do you think?
Well, it's a political recipe for helping people, but the fact is it leaves a terrible taste in the mouth of young people, people at the lower end of the wage scale. I think most politicians think that businesses operate with plenty of margin, but the difference between a $5 wage and a $7 wage may be the difference between being able to hire people at all, and it doesn't matter what a wage is if there's no job there for somebody to be hired into.
Mark Levine, what do you say?
You know, even if you have no compassion whatsoever for poor people, you have to recognize that a minimum wage both stimulates the economy and helps save taxpayer dollars. It stimulates the economy because poor people, $100 to them is like a pot of gold. It's that last bit of money a poor single mother needs to pay the rent or to feed her family. To a rich guy, it's like a typo in a bank account. And that prevents her from going on welfare, becoming homeless, needing unemployment insurance, which costs us taxpayers a lot of money. So it's not just about compassion. It helps the economy.
Mark, what if she just didn't get the job at all because of the minimum wage?
Well, then she'd probably go on welfare, and we taxpayers would have to pay for it anyway.
No. My question is, what if she didn't get a job because the wage is so high, the minimum wage is so high, that the employer feels she doesn't have enough skills, so it's not worth hiring her?
Then we taxpayers would have to fund her on welfare or unemployment. It'd be better to have her fund herself, isn't it?
Terry?
It's such a basic lack of understanding here. Jobs have to be created in order for people to be able to support themselves. And in a political environment, minimum wage bills sound good. But when it comes to actually creating jobs, we've got to get off the back of business, get out of the way, and lower taxes so that they can grow their businesses and create jobs. This minimum wage thing, the Wall Street Journal has it exactly right.
Mark?
There's more than a 50% unemployment rate among black teenagers. I mean, doesn't anybody really care?
Mark?
So you hear, we're talking past each other, right? I'm talking about the real economic effects. If someone doesn't get a decent wage, they're not going to take that job. They'll just go on welfare. Now, you could argue, as some conservatives do, that welfare shouldn't exist, that poor people should just die. And you can make that argument if you want. I actually don't think most Americans agree with you. If you want to make that argument, give me a call, 888-653-7543. Let me know that you think that way. That's fine. You have a right to your opinion. But most Americans think that we should have these minimum standards. But if we have minimum standards, then people make choices. They can choose to work that minimum wage job or to stay on welfare. And if an employer says, that's too much, we're not going to hire you, that person's on welfare, right? That costs taxpayers money. So even if you have no compassion whatsoever for the poor person, recognize that we taxpayers save bucks if we give people enough of a wage for them to pay for themselves. Now, the Republican, all he can do is spout his talking points. He doesn't address my argument. Listen, they try to get me to address, I guess, their argument. Listen to the rest of the clip.
Oh, I'm going to try this one more time.
All right.
The conservative argument against the minimum wage is that people who don't have skills actually don't get jobs. So I understand the argument is once you have the job, maybe you're making more money and so you spend more. But the idea is that the minimum wage prevents poor people from actually ever getting the job. So they end up more on welfare than they would have before because of the minimum wage. Do you disagree with that?
I do disagree with that. I've seen the standard economic models. But I also know that a minimum wage gives poor people the kind of power that, say, a rich CEO has. A poor kid from Brooklyn doesn't have that kind of power to negotiate a better price. Look, if they're trying to learn a trade and they get a decent wage, they're going to stick at that job rather than if they take a small wage, they may just leave the job. So it helps the employer as well.
Terry?
I just think it's ridiculous. I mean, you want businesses to grow and expand so that they can hire people not at a minimum wage, but at a competitive wage, at a wage they can live on and succeed in. It seems to me to go totally against a free enterprise that we're going to start making jobs an entitlement in this country.
Mark,
that's
why do you think
ultimately
unemployment
the last
is higher
straw
among teenagers?
Well, teenagers don't have the skills that other people do. I agree with that. But you got to remember, the minimum wage, 3/4 of the minimum wage earners are adults. More than half of them are the primary wage earners for their families. So to talk all about teenagers,
and 60% of them work in industries like restaurants, et cetera, where they actually get tips and don't actually get the minimum wage.
Well, it depends on which minimum wage figures you're looking at. The figures I've seen, it's 4.5 million Americans. It's about 3% of the population.
And 60% of it, yeah, I'm looking at the BLS right here, right. All right, guys, thank you. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Have you back.
Thank you.
Okay, so that's the end of the clip. Now, it's fascinating to me because the argument they're making really is free enterprise. Right. These spin words, these free enterprise. We need free enterprise. As if free enterprise in and of itself were a good thing. It's almost like I might talk about the Constitution or religion or God, right? The free enterprise is always good. We should always have free markets. No, you know, unless you're of the free market religion, free markets are just a means to an end. Right? The invisible hand of Adam Smith. It's a means to an end. Free markets work when they work. And when they work, they're terrific, right? Competition among restaurants. You mentioned restaurants. Competition among car manufacturers. Competition among booksellers. Whatever it is, right? That works. But some things don't work with the free market. For example, healthcare. For example, firemen. For example, police officers. For example, the fact that your electricity bill is regulated by the state and your gas bill and your water bill is regulated by the state. Some things a free market does best, no question. I am not a pure socialist. Some things the government does best, no question. I'm not a pure capitalist. But they intone free market, free market, free market, as if they don't recognize the real problems of the free market. And in this case, the free market can leave a lot of people dirt poor. And if we're going to pay for them anyway, because we have a little bit of compassion, then you have to ask yourself, wouldn't it be better if they earned their own living? Now, for all the Republicans and conservatives who've condemned welfare queens over all the years and say people need to work, and then they just turn around and say not only should they work, but they should work for a substandard wage. The minimum wage in America, $7.25. Do you know what you get if you work 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year? $14,500. That's still below the poverty line, which is about $17,000 or so. So you work all that time. As I point out, the majority of minimum wage earners are the primary wage earners for their family. 3/4 of them are adults. But Republicans are so believing in the mantra of the free market that they're willing to let real people's lives be destroyed. More importantly, because they don't care about the poor people, they're raising the deficit for us taxpayers. Hey, fiscal conservatives, at least you should care about that. And then, of course, there's the last thing, too. Poor people and middle-class people are the engines of the economy. A poor person getting $100 has got to spend it. She needs the money for rent. She needs the money for food. $100 to a rich person, that's just a number in a bank account. So when a poor person gets money, they spend it. That stimulates the economy. It's not just about compassion, my friends. It's about what works best. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Back after the news. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine, your second favorite talk show host. Oh, do we get my song in there? I'm a man. There you go. Woman's song gone. We're taking over. No, we're not. Don't worry. Leslie Marshall will be back next week. But no, I've been talking about how we frame issues. And when you mention words like poverty or guns, or gay rights, or global warming, people have very different images in their mind. And what I'm trying to show by playing some of my clips on CNBC or Fox is how I argue with conservatives. Because I try to use logic. It's the only thing we have in common. We Americans will never have our emotions in common. Liberals seeing poor people as people deserving of help, good people who are trying hard, and conservatives seeing poor people as a bunch of criminals and welfare frauds, right? Our emotions aren't going to change. So I'm going to use logic to try to persuade the conservatives that even if you hate poor people, even if you have no compassion for poor people, even if you only care about your tax money and the economy, guess what? The minimum wage helps decrease the amount you have to pay in taxes and helps the economy. Even if you refuse to see the Second Amendment the way it is, I'm going to argue, hey, look, we need reasonable gun regulation. Because if the right to bear arms is for every individual, well, then I guess violent felons and crazy people get to have guns. And since you don't believe that, conservative, let's not stop talking about the Second Amendment and start talking about what's reasonable gun control and what's not. The heart of my argument is, liberals have their emotional bias, no question. Conservatives have their emotional bias, no question. Fundamentalist Christians have their emotional bias. Atheists have their emotional bias. Everybody's got an emotional bias. But the only way we can talk to each other across from that emotional bias is, yes, using logic, as humdrum as that may be. And Joe from Buffalo has been hanging on a very long time. Joe, welcome to the show.
How you doing, Mark? The way you frame the arguments, very clear, very concise, very to the point, and that's the way you're gonna reach out to people. Some of the talk show hosts, both liberal and conservative, they tend to frame it and on the emotional level. And what you've been saying tonight, I'm so glad that America is hearing this because
Thank
this
you,
is
Joe.
The way to address these issues.
Thank you, Joe. I mean, that's exactly my point. You know, emotion only plays in some quarters, right? Sarah Palin's fundamentalist Christian emotion will play to fundamentalist Christians, absolutely, but it's not going to play to people outside her faith, right?
Right. I figure, like liberals like us, we have the emotion. We care about the people. We have a deep-seated care for the disadvantaged.
Right.
Okay? That's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. We should be proud of that. But if we can frame it, like you say, from the dollars and cents logic to capture a few of those Republicans.
Exactly.
Okay.
And no,
then
Joe.
We're
exactly.
We're going to be able to pass universal health care.
Exactly.
We're going to be able to raise a wage to a living wage so that all workers can realize a little bit of the American dream.
You're never going to convince a Republican to support universal health care by pointing to a 5-year-old with leukemia. Because you need compassion.
Right.
That's just, I mean, you either got it or you don't. I mean, if you don't have compassion for a dying child, I can't help instill it. But I can explain to you how the dying child is using up emergency health care when, in fact, it would be cheaper to treat the child and let the child live than to pay for all that emergency care. So I can appeal in dollars and cents across the emotional divide to someone who really doesn't give a damn about the child.
Well,
exactly.
You just keep doing that because I think that's a good way of approaching it. And I just wanted to say, I think you're quickly becoming my favorite radio.
You're so sweet. Well, then, you know what? If you do like me, go ahead, check out my website, marklevineradio.com. Join my mailing list, and I'll be happy to let you know when I'm arguing things because I appreciate good fans. But I also appreciate people who disagree with me. Thank you very much for your call. Joe, let's hear what Bob in Brooklyn has to say.
Hello, Mark.
Hi, Bob.
Really enjoying the show.
Thank you.
Look, Eric Severide once did an editorial on TV. He said, any person who holds a strong ideology is practicing self-deception. You cannot reason with people on the extremes, either left or right. You cannot use logic because they want to believe their own falsehoods. Now, there are some very progressive talk show hosts. I pick up this station from Buffalo, WWKB.
Right.
And, you know, there's a woman, fine person, who comes on before Leslie Marshall. She thinks she can win over the teabaggers.
Randy Rhodes, you're talking about?
Yeah, I love Randy. But you cannot win over the teabaggers. She thinks the corporations can be defeated by forming like a working person's coalition with the teabaggers. I see the teabaggers as the problem. Now, look, an evil corporation is this Wellpoint. I think it's the ones that own all the Blue Crosses.
Right.
They have no conscience. They are robber barons.
Right.
But who is empowering them? I don't see the teabaggers as being innocent, ignorant people who are being manipulated by the corporations. I see the teabag types as empowering the corporations. Now, let's take this a step further, if I may. This so-called Christian coalition.
Right.
There's like over 30 million of these people.
Sure.
Now, I once read a book written by Pat Robertson. It's called The New World Order. This man thinks that the federal government is part of some international communist conspiracy.
Yeah, he's a little crazy. Okay, he's a lot crazy.
Now,
he
these teabaggers buy into this stuff. Now, you're not going to change their mind because they want to believe this. They're acting strictly out of emotion. Now, I've talked to conservatives. I know conservatives in my neighborhood. I've tried to reason with them, saying, you vote Republican, you're voting against your own self-interest.
Right.
They don't care. If I may just take this to the realm of foreign policy.
Okay.
I've told people, look, person you admire, Ronald Reagan, he lied. He was a pathological liar on foreign policy. When he ran against Jimmy Carter, he's on record. He said the Soviet Union was ahead of the United States in every type of strategic and conventional weapon. It's not true. I know it's not true. It's a fact. They weren't ahead of us. In anything, they weren't ahead of us. In nothing, they were ahead of us.
Bob, let me suggest to you a middle ground, as it were, between you and Randy Rhodes. Because I think you're both right, and I think you're both wrong. And I'll tell you why. I think it is wrong to say, as you tell me Randy Rhodes says, that every person in the Tea Party movement can be convinced in a working person's coalition. I think that's too idealistic. I admit that. But I also think that you're too pessimistic. I am not going to call the Tea Party a monolithic group. In fact, they clearly don't agree on everything. They're fighting amongst themselves. I believe in that people are people, and some of them, you're absolutely right, cannot be convinced. They're all emotion. They're impervious to logic. It's like beating your head against the wall. I agree with you that some, maybe even most, of them are like that. But I'm still not willing to give up, and maybe this is my own idealism in me. I think that we can work across party lines even to show where we have in common, that sometimes logic can trump emotion. And I think one of the ways to do that is to not bring up emotional words. You just called Ronald Reagan a pathological liar. If you do that, you're never going to convince a Tea Party person of anything. They're going to see you as emotional. If you want to make your point about Ronald Reagan and Soviet Union, say Ronald Reagan had his facts incorrect. Now, that's the same kind of thing,
no,
right? You call him a pathological liar because you think it was intentional. That's fine. But the man is dead. We can't really know his intent. I'm not defending Ronald Reagan. Trust me, I'm not. What I'm saying is, if you want to talk to someone who disagrees with you, rather than using terms like pathological liar, if you say Reagan had his facts incorrect, and then the two of you go and look together and see what the facts are, this is a way to build bridges without just angering people. You see what I'm saying?
Can I rebut that?
Sure.
I disagree. Ronald Reagan, when he was still in his early 50s, it's on record, it's in books, would tell people, reporters, that he served in combat overseas in Europe in World War II.
Right.
He never left Southern California.
Right.
Now, these teabag people, when they were demonstrating against Obama last summer in Washington, D.C., they were prominently displaying the state flag of Alabama. Now, why would anyone put up the flag of Alabama? Since when do people bring a state flag to a demonstration?
Because it has a Confederate flag on it, right?
It looks like the Confederate flag.
Exactly.
If I may just conclude by saying this. Germany made a mistake twice, in 1933 and in 1945. In 33, the conservatives thought they could form a coalition with the Nazis, and in 45, the social democrats thought they could form a coalition with the communists. These teabaggers, I think, are innately evil people.
Look, I hear you. I'm going to agree with you that anyone that carries the Alabama flag, or particularly the people who, the birthers, right, who claimed that Obama wasn't born in the United States, these are racists. These are people we can't deal with. These are people of pure emotion. Maybe, if you want to just call me too idealistic, fine. You know, I accept that. I may well be. But I guess my view is, it's, you know, the Tea Party people. There are people that march in the streets. There are people that listen to Sarah Palin and liked what they hear. There are people who have sympathy with some of what the Tea Party says. All I'm saying is this. I don't want to ever give up on my fellow Americans. I'll give up on some of them. But if we're ever going to build a coalition, and this is, I guess, where I'm agreeing with Randy Rhodes, we have to persuade people that of the facts. And some people will never reach. Bob, you're absolutely right. Some people will never reach. I'm not disagreeing with you. But I can't think we can give up on trying. A lot of the Tea Party movement, in my view, as angry and as racist and as evil as some of those people are, a lot of it, to me, is just pure, raw, unfocused anger. people have high unemployments, they're suffering, they're losing their jobs, and they're white working class people who are looking for an enemy. And sometimes, yeah, they look for blacks. Sometimes, you know, the Nazis blame the Jews because these were poor Germans who were suffering in the Great Depression. I'm not saying they're not dangerous. They're extremely dangerous. But I'm also saying that most of these people, heck, even the Ku Klux Klan today is pathetic because they're people who are hurting and are often reaching out, taking their hurt in very destructive, very dangerous ways. I still think we can reach out to people of any persuasion and at least convince some of them. And if I didn't believe that, heck, I wouldn't be talking to Republicans the way I often do. But I want to know what you think. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is your second favorite talk show host, Mark Levine, filling in for the great Leslie Marshall. She will be back next week, I hope, I expect. I'm always honored to have her give her baby to me. And of course, that's who you are, her audience. And I like you very much, even those who disagree with me. And, you know, I've been thinking about what Bob from Brooklyn has said. And, you know, I don't know that he's wrong. I understand his frustration. I really do, particularly when I'm arguing with conservatives. Now, a lot of this argument, you know, on Fox or CNBC, whatever, this is all very stylized. I'm not going to convince the other person. It is their job to disagree with me. The real question is, am I convincing anyone out there in the audience? And, you know, when I get the comments, like on my website, saying that, without arguing the Second Amendment, just that I'm wrong, and they say I'm wrong, and they call me all kinds of names, then I wonder, yeah, emotion, or maybe just the people who post on my website are full of emotion. So heck, if you agree with me, post on my website. Let me know you're there. MarkLevineRadio.com, MarkLevine Radio.com. Let me know you're there, because I'm hoping that there's at least one Tea Partier out there, one conservative, heck, one moderate independent, I'll take it, one Republican, who's willing to listen to logic, who's willing to sit down and avoid the emotional arguments, or at least accept them and move on and see logically what is right. But maybe I'm just a hopeless idealist. Let's see what Dean from Buffalo thinks. Dean, welcome to the show.
Just want to say you're doing a great job filling in.
Well, thank you.
Now here comes the unfortunate part.
Uh-oh. I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm sitting down. I'm ready. Go for it.
I disagree with you because America is a nation of everything we do, whether it's electing our leaders. Barack Obama, of course, was elected because of the people's outpouring of emotions. We were formed as a
nation. You think Obama was just elected on emotions? You don't think he was elected based on logic, based on Republicans running the country to the ground, or corruption? Or it's all based on emotions?
Well,
some of it was, but all of it?
I think a large part of it, because we were so upset that our leaders weren't listening to us.
Right.
We were looking for just anybody else to go against what George Bush and Dick Cheney were doing.
Well, sure, but that's logical. That's not just emotional, right? If a democratically elected leader is not listening to you, that can make you angry, but that's also a logical reason to choose a new leader. So in that case, logic and emotion aren't at odds.
I mean, take the stimulus, for example.
Okay.
The stimulus was passed in large part because we were so fearful in emotion that our nation was going to go through another Great Depression.
Right.
So we panicked, and we put through an unethically high amount of money to people on Wall Street who basically caused us to be on the doorstep of another Great Depression.
Well, let me talk about that, because that's a very, very touchy issue. It's a good issue to discuss, and it's complex. And it's one of the reasons why I'm glad I'm a talk radio host, because when I'm on TV, there's no time to talk about such an issue. I think it's an important one to discuss. In my view, and this is a very unpopular view, and President Obama holds this view too, and he says talking about it is like getting a root canal. But in my very unpopular view, the bankers, the gamblers, the insurance companies, the ones that were using federally insured fund to go out and gamble trillions of dollars for their own greed, took our economy and took it hostage. And it's very much like taking a person hostage, where you give in to the demands of the hostage taker just to get the hostage freed. Financial depressions are the absolute worst depressions around. The 1929 depression was a financial depression. And you can look at economic history and you know that the business cycle goes up, it goes down. But when you have no credit in the economy, when you have credit is the lifeblood of the economy. And when banks aren't giving credit, even when it's based on their own nefarious conduct, unfortunately, they cause it and it hits us, right? They go and they throw a grenade up in the air and it lands on us. It landed on the economy and we were suffering even more than they were. So even though I hated the bailouts, I actually think they were necessary in order to take an economy that was falling very, very fast and to make it good. But I'll tell you this, I believe in getting every single dollar of that back. I like that Barack Obama is going to tax the banks to get every dollar of it back. And I also think that, well, we should tax them more and regulate them more so this never can happen again. They took us hostage once. They did. They did it. I admit it. We paid off the ransom. But let's fix the system so they can never take us hostage again. 888-653-7543. 888-6-LESLIE. Right back after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine, your second favorite talk show host. You know, right before the break, I was defending the financial bailouts, and it was tearing me up inside. I hate defending the financial bailouts. I hate it. This is actually a case, and I'm kind of proud of myself here. This is a case where my own logic overtakes my own emotion. So I'm actually really glad that, even though it was painful for me, I'm really glad that Dean from Buffalo brought up the topic. Because emotionally, I hate those bailouts. Those bankers should be in jail. They took the safe practices of banking and insurance that are federally regulated and should be, or state regulated as well, and should be regulated because of the Great Depression, because we understand these financial instruments can be used to cause great damage to the economy. And so we have regulations, we have insurance, we make sure that insurance companies have a certain amount of money kept in reserves, we make sure that banks have a certain amount of money kept in reserves, we do all this to prevent the Great Depression from happening again, and what do? Using conservative policies that get rid of regulations, they go and they gamble all this money on credit derivative swaps, which is worst gambling. Heck, you know, when I play poker in Atlantic City, I got a chance of winning. Credit derivative swaps was one big Ponzi scheme, and then the whole economy falls apart, and they want a bailout, and now Mark Levine is defending it. I hate that. But this is where my degree in economics overtakes my own emotion. My heart hated it, but I understood that just like a terrorist who's busy shooting hostages, the hostages are harmed more than the terrorist. And once we free the hostages, go out and kill the terrorists. Once we save the economy, go out and regulate the banks. Absolutely. But unfortunately, yeah, I think it's necessary. But this is proof that I'm an adult, that I can let my own logic overtake my own emotion. How do you like that? So thank you, Dean, for bringing it up. And now I got a whole bunch of callers who are going to, sure, I'm going to read me the Riot Act. But let's start with James from York, Pennsylvania. James, welcome to the show. Go ahead, James. You're on the air. James?
I truly understand what you're saying, but, you know, if we use real logic, man, we could really solve this thing very, very, very simple. You know, with the Republicans always finding fault and always talking about the logical thing to do would be to cut spending and balance the budgets and stuff.
Right.
Why don't we just take them straight on and say, okay, here's what we did. From this point on, we'll go state by state, the money, all those things that we spend on these different projects that these Republicans and Democrats, let's just cut these things out and let's balance the budget. And then put it up there and say, everything that we do from this point on, we pay for. And take them straight on and say, okay, we're going to have tax cuts, but we got to pay for it. And then put that out there and let them vote on it.
You know, James, the Democrats have done that. I mean, they have said, in fact, that we're going to do pay as you go. We're going to make.
Yeah, but I'm talking about what I'm talking about is not just say it. I'm saying do it.
Well, they did do it. Okay. That's my point. The Democrats passed pay-as-you-go. What is pay-as-you-go? Pay-as-you-go says that any time you have a program, a federal spending program, you got to pay for it. You got to raise taxes or cut spending somewhere else. The Republicans voted against it. The Democrats voted for it. But you know what? At the end of the day, I support pay-as-you-go in general, but I don't support the Democrats saying, when we're in power, we're going to be fiscally wise. We're going to make sure we don't spend a big deficit. But when you Republicans are in power, you can spend out whatever you want because Democrats and Republicans have different priorities. Democrats want to make sure children get health care. Republicans want to fight a war against a country that never attacked us. They want to give money to oil companies, pharmaceutical companies. If we allow them to do what they want to do and not pay for it, and then we have to pay for everything we do, it limits the Democratic agenda and doesn't limit the Republican agenda. We have to combine as one. And that's why I really support Barack Obama's budget deficit commission.
Just let me say this one thing. I wasn't talking. I understand what you're saying about that, but I'm saying whatever they put forward, then make them pay for it also.
Well, I mean, think we should.
It's not to let them do what they want to do.
No, I understand, but James,
make it so that they would have to say, well, you know, then they would be exposed.
James, we do that, but they broke the rules. Listen, James, we had that rule. That whatever they did, they have to pay for it. It was there. And what did George Bush do? He came in and he wanted tax cuts that he couldn't pay for. And the Democrats said, no, you have to pay for it. Well, let me tell you what he did. Let me tell you what he did. He used, James, he used budget reconciliation and got a 50-vote majority and rammed it through. The same thing they're complaining about now. That's what Bush did. Go ahead.
I understand that. But what I'm saying is, you know how they all walk the same walk and talk the same talk?
Most of them.
You know, we allow those people to get out in front of all these arguments, and then we have to play catch-up. I'm saying then it should be total exposure. That's what the conversation should be. You should not allow these people just to run their mouths and say whatever they want. When you just laid it out to me, but that's not what's being told out there.
I hear you, James. Let me tell you something. That is why I am in radio. I am in radio specifically to respond to these arguments, and that's why I'm playing some of them on the air. So thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. That's why I do what I do, to respond, to not just let them run their mouth, but to give cogent, logical arguments beyond the emotional ones to combat the Republicans. Let's go to Ken from Buffalo. Ken, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, you know, regarding those banks, I keep thinking what Barack Obama did with General Motors, and I kind of wish he had done the same thing with the banks. You know, take the one who's at the top of any institution that is causing trouble for the people in this country and fire him.
You know what? I agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. You got to remember, though, the bank bailout began under George Bush. And in fact, most of it happened under George Bush. Everyone's blaming Obama for it. 2/3 of the money went out under Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and under George Bush and was supported by John McCain. Obama pretty much just did the end of it. But you know what? I agree with you. You're absolutely right. He should have said, as a condition of getting further money, the CEOs, the head of the banks, have to be fired. You're absolutely right. I couldn't agree with you more. How's that?
And I'm actually just warming up a little here because I would then take the other executives below the chief executive officer out on a boat ride. And you know how the old pirate ships used to have that plank? And I think I'd take the other executives one at a time to the edge of the plank and say, anybody who wants a $10 million bonus, take one step forward.
Yeah. I'll tell you, Ken, the really scary thing about what caused this economic depression is not what was illegal, but what was legal. That's the really scary thing. Most of these people did legal things. And so I support crazy ways to fight them. I would support like that 90% tax they were talking about in the House on the bonuses. Yeah, just tax 90% of it. See if they still want it after that. Hey, I need to take two more calls. So I want to thank you for your call and move on quickly to Josh in Burlington, Vermont. Go ahead, Josh.
Oh, hi, Mark. You're putting out a great show tonight.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I'm calling up about George Soros. He's a billionaire, and every once in a while he makes a contribution to the Democratic Party.
Right.
Whenever he does, the hatred and the demonization of George Soros by the Republicans is absolutely amazing.
Did you hear Bill O'Reilly with me? Did you hear that clip?
Yeah.
Yeah, Bill O'Reilly said, George Soros said some crazy thing about nationalizing the banks, and he's the leader of the progressives. He's not our leader. He's a man. He's a rich man who gives liberal causes. Rush Limbaugh is far more the leader of the Republicans than George. I mean, Rush Limbaugh, Michael Steele says something, you know, the head of the Republican National Committee says something that's arguably derogatory against Rush Limbaugh, and then he's forced to apologize, you know, scrimp and go on his knees and say, please, Rush, forgive me. Because Rush really is the leader of the Republican Party. Most Democrats don't give a damn what George Soros says. He's a man. He's a rich man. All right, whatever. He's got his own views. But you're absolutely right.
About a lot of people. Could you tell us two or three Republican equivalents of George Soros?
Oh, what, rich Republicans? Oh, Roger Ailes, the head of Fox News, comes immediately to mind. Rupert Murdoch. There's a heck of Ken Lay. He died, of course, the head of Enron. You know, all the chairmen of CEOs of most major corporations, whether it's Exxon or Mobil or Dick Cheney was CEO of Halliburton and had millions of dollars. I mean, the head of Walmart. I mean, I can go on and on and on. Most billionaires happen to be Republican. Now, not all of them are. Warren Buffett is. Sometimes if you become a super billionaire, you go back to being liberal again because you have so much money.
You don't have to worry.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about it at all. So like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett often support liberal causes. But at the end of the day, I don't think that's a worthwhile discussion. I guess I don't think it's worthwhile to say, oh, this crazy person supports the Republican Party, therefore Republicans are crazy. I don't think that argument is correct, right? If the Ku Klux Klan supports George W. Bush, it may be interesting, but it doesn't mean, therefore, that George W. Bush is racist, right? You may ask yourself why, right? I mean, if the Communist Party supports Barack Obama, it doesn't mean Barack Obama is a communist. So if George Soros supports the Democratic Party, it doesn't mean the Democratic Party is owned by George Soros. So I just think so I don't really want to make that argument in return for the Republicans. Rush Limbaugh, though, is different, and the reason he's different is because the leader of the Republican National Committee, Michael Steele, when he made comments that were arguably critical of Rush Limbaugh, he was forced to apologize. When Republican senators and members of Congress say something that's in any way critical of Rush Limbaugh, they have to turn around and apologize. It's that apology that tells you that Republicans are owned by Rush Limbaugh, not the fact that he supports the Republican Party. Thanks very much for your call. We'll take a few more calls when we come back. 888-653-7543 right after this. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie. I want to thank everyone who has called. I've really enjoyed the 3 hours talking about logic versus emotion. I got two more calls left. Let's go first to Peter in Niagara Falls. Peter, welcome to the show. Are you there?
Hey, Mark.
Hi, Peter.
Just wanted to kind of just give my take on Second
All right,
Amendment.
Go for
make
it.
Make my point.
All right, make your point.
Okay.
I got my Constitution ready. I'm just pulling it out now. I was like, this is my weapon. You have yours. I have mine. Ready? Go.
Okay. Now, simple question just requires an obvious yes or no answer.
Some do, some don't. Go ahead.
Now, the Constitution was drafted to be a document that was to be the citizen's shield of protection from the state. Would you agree or disagree?
I agree. And also the people's. Both an individual, it has individual rights in it, and it has collective rights in it. It has both in it. Yes.
Okay. Now, basically the argument that you're trying to make is that you have all the legal protections from the state. Now, okay, basically here, I'm kind of losing my train of thought here. So now you agree that the citizens do need protection from the state. So there's an entity of which we need protection from, correct?
Sure, but we also control that entity through democracy and so forth. So it's against abuses of the estate.
So the document is our legal protection, but...
Right, and we don't have complete protection. I mean, they can still tax us and things.
The document was written for the citizens.
For the people, yeah.
Yeah, we the people.
Right.
So you're trying to make the argument here that the entire document, except for the Second Amendment, okay, is a protection for the citizens where, say, the Second Amendment, basically, you're saying that they wrote it that the state is to have the monopoly on force.
No. No, I think that the people, in a well-regulated militia, which could be, and according to the Constitution, it's something where the states appoint the officers and the federal government regulates it. It was a way to combine federal and state freedom. In other words, if the federal government leads to tyranny, you got your states to protect you. And if the state governments are become tyrannical, you have your federal government to protect you. It wasn't meant, though, to have a separate right apart from the state and the federal government.
Okay, but all this—you're still talking about state control, though.
Sure.
With them, yeah. Okay, but that's not separate. The state is still that's still separate from the citizens. I mean, I know you say.
Well, it is, but you understand.
And all this stuff, but still, the state is separate.
It is, but you understand. Not every amendment to the Constitution is about separating citizens from the states. The 10th Amendment, for example, specifically reserves powers to the states. Or to the people, it says to both. So some of this document is about state power, and some of it is about individual power, and some of it is about collective power, the right of the people as a people. When it says we the people have the right to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, it doesn't mean that every individual is going to go around establishing justice or providing for the common defense. It means that we the people collectively have the right to justice and a common defense. We the people collectively have the right to have a well-regulated militia to secure our free state. But it doesn't mean that we as individuals have that right. Let me ask you a question, because clearly you support the individual right, and I respect your view. Do you believe if the individual right exists, then wouldn't that individual right apply to violent felons? Because they're individuals and they're citizens. Shouldn't violent felons and mentally ill people also be able to own guns?
Yeah, but with restrictions, they will get them regardless.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about. Get them legally? Get them constitutionally? Get them under
the
radar?
So if you
get them illegally?
No, but here's the point I was trying to make, though. You're saying, though, that the Second Amendment was written so that your citizen who's not, say, I don't know, registered with...
The Minutemen! The Minutemen of Concord, Massachusetts had rifles in their homes, and when the British came in, they all came together in a well-regulated militia. That's
who
he's talking about.
As it applies today, you're saying that unless you're with the National Guard...
National Guard, exactly.
...and whatnot, then if you're just... You're Joe Sixpack...
Right.
That Second Amendment doesn't apply to you.
Exactly. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't have guns. See, you don't have to have a constitutional right to have a right, right? I mean, the for example, the Third Amendment is almost never used. The Third Amendment says no soldier can be quartered in your house. I've researched this just out of interest because every one of the amendments has a long line of jurisprudence. The Third Amendment's got nothing because apparently no one ever tried to quarter a soldier in your house in the United States of America. So you look it up in the law books and there's nothing there. So some of these things, you know, when they talk about the Electoral College, I think that's kind of archaic. It's still there. They talk about a 3/5 clause, right? We know that's not there anymore. So some of the Constitution, yeah, it's kind of archaic. But militias do exist. The National Guards do exist. And I think the Second Amendment protects them. That doesn't mean you can't have your guns. You don't have to have a constitutional right to have rights, right? There's no constitutional right to, to health care, for example, but I still think everyone should have health care. There's no constitutional right to a firefighting force, but I still think we should have firefighters in every city. So just because there's no constitutional right doesn't mean the right can't exist. I appreciate your call. I wouldn't cut you off, except I got a ton of people on the line, and I want to see if I can get to both of them. Let's go to Chris in Ridgecrest, California. Welcome to the show. Is Chris gone?
Hello?
Go ahead, Chris.
Hi. I don't have it in front of me, but there was a thing called the Militia Act of 17-something that was in effect until 1903, and it addressed the problem of the citizen militias not being properly equipped to do the task.
Mm-hmm.
And it said that every able-bodied citizen of the United States should have such and such type of rifle, such... you know, type of ammunition. So the Militia Act was in effect for a long time.
Ah, but what did the Militia Act say? The Militia Act said that every able-bodied, and to me, a person who's mentally ill is not able-bodied. Someone who's a violent felon can't or shouldn't be in a militia. What that act said is that you can, and I think you can, constitutionally require people to own guns to defend their country. But that doesn't mean it's unconstitutional to regulate guns, right?
No,
that doesn't mean the same thing.
I would like to address the word regulated, because over time, like,
gotta be real quick,
gay,
though.
The word gay used to mean happy until recently. Now the word gay has changed meaning.
All right.
Regulated means trained.
I agree.
Okay? It doesn't mean restricted. It means trained.
I agree, and I'll tell you
trained.
Something. I will fully support your constitutional right under the Second Amendment to a well-trained militia. Absolutely. You got that right. All Americans have that right. There's an absolute militia right in the Second Amendment. I agree. I just don't think it's an individual right. James in Felton, Delaware, I'm going to give you 30 seconds. That's all you got, because my time's running out, friend. Go ahead, real quick. Go.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
As far as the Second Amendment goes, you said the Congress decides who's regulated.
Yes. That's in the first Article 1, Section 8.
Right. So, I mean, if you have a conservative Congress or a liberal Congress, it's going to mean different things, really, isn't it?
Well, that's right, and that's the right that Congress has. I'm afraid I'm going to have to end it there because I'm out of time. I want to thank everybody for calling in, for listening. If you want to know more about me, you can go to marklevineradio.com. Post on my blog. Let me know what you thought of today. If you disagree with me, that's okay, too. Some guy called me an effing moron. You can read what he wrote, too. So I can handle it if you disagree. If you agree, that's great. If you really agree, click on email. Send me an email. I'll put you on my mailing list. You can even Facebook me. I'm going to put up a fan page. I've been meaning to do that. I'm a little slow. Right now, I just got an individual thing. But let me know you like the show. Let me know. And the other thing about my website, I'll just one quick plug, marklevineradio.com. You can see me against Bill O'Reilly. You can see me against the conservatives, whether it's CNBC or Fox Business or Bill O'Reilly. I take them on. In fact, I have a wonderful discussion I didn't even get a chance to get to with Eric Bowling on global warming. So check me out. And I'm sure your favorite radio host, Leslie Marshall, will be back next week. This is Mark Levine signing off.